So I think we can talk now. I'm Patrick Martins.
Pacifico.
You're Shauna what?
Pacifico.
There we go.
What it go?
Pacifico. Shauna Pacifico.
I had a friend named Donnie Atlantico.
You did it.
He was more of an East Coast guy.
Oh, that's not true.
But you were ironically brought up on the East Coast.
I was brought up in Florida. I don't know if you really consider that the East Coast.
Yeah, that's kind of its own little island, isn't it?
Yes.
Peninsula. Well, we should say a few things. We should take care of some business.
Yes, let's
first
do that.
First is we're about to drop sound effect C10. You ready, guys, in the back? We're about to make a drop.
This is Joe Bastianich, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
God, they're screwing around back there. All right. So, we have a sponsor, which is White Oak Pastures.
Mm, that's nice.
It's actually a very interesting beef guy who opened an abattoir on his farm.
Oh, and where's his farm?
Georgia. Hmm. He's actually also on the board of the Georgia Organics Conference.
Great.
Ooh, a pancake delivery.
Ricotta pancakes.
There was an Onion article once. Do you know the Onion?
No. Oh, the Onion.
Yeah.
I thought you meant an article about onions.
Oh.
I was like, there have been many.
It says, Alzheimer's patients call for cure for pancakes. I always thought that was funny. But so what's been going on, Shauna? Thanks for sitting in. I mean, you're going to be sitting in for a few weeks, hopefully, if you have a good time.
I always have a good time when I come here. This is always fun. It's a nice little Sunday thing to do here at Roberta's. The food's always good. And you always get a picture of mimosa, so that makes me.
Oh, my God. That's the worst thing. Now Roberta's is bartenders are like, we can't sustain that type of orange production.
Oh, that's right. I shouldn't have said that. No pictures.
We have a sound effect for that, too. Guys, you ready in the back? We're going to drop another sound.
Oh, that's a new one.
Well, that's for the mimosa one. Yeah. Well, we're going to get a whole bunch of new sound effects.
I think you should have farm animals.
Ooh.
Like cows and pigs and chickens.
Well, we are today engineered by Nat Wiener, who has a little bit of a drinking problem. No, just during the show, he's like, I'm leaving my station. No, and then now we are produced by Jack Inslee. So those guys are pretty, and I think his name is also RecTech.
RecTech.
In the computer world.
Is that like slang for I can wreck your tech?
Exactly. Did you go out? Do you ever eat out, Shauna?
I actually, this summer, haven't eaten out very much.
Okay.
Because it's been so busy at Back 40. Actually, last week I went to the Farm on Adderley, which is out near where I live.
What is that, a restaurant?
It's a restaurant. Okay. It's, you know, it's the local sustainable organic restaurant in my neighborhood. And it's the only restaurant in the neighborhood. But it was good.
Cool. And but most of the time you're at Back 40. Do you eat at Back 40? Like, do chefs eat big meals at their own restaurants?
I actually eat my lunch and dinner at Back 40 most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Lunch is usually I'll come in and snack on whatever's open in the walk-in.
So you'll make your own thing on your own. You won't order like off the menu and eat a cheeseburger?
No, I eat family meal.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, family meal.
What do you do for family meal?
It's
an interesting, there's a big market.
Saturdays are always hot dog day because we all love hot dogs. Cooks love hot dogs.
Really?
They do. It was really strange for me to figure that out. But
it's actually one of the most sustainable things because, you know, a slice of pizza is a big, cheesy, bready thing. A hot dog is like in and out. You could have a few a day. I mean, it's like the salami, you know, in mm-hmm. Italy. You cut a little piece off. It gets you through the next few hours.
Yeah. Taco Tuesdays are my favorite.
Taco Tuesdays.
Yes.
How, soft shell, hard shell?
No, soft shell corn tortillas.
Is that the back of the house clamored for traditional?
Yes, very traditional. Traditional in the sense that we use the corn tortillas, but we're always just using whatever scrap meats or vegetables we can.
When I once asked Alice Waters, is it possible to franchise a sustainable, slow idea? She was always like, with tortillas. There could be a million tortilla.
I love tortillas.
Yeah.
I could eat them breakfast, lunch, dinner.
You would buy like a 20-pack
or
something for a buck.
We'll go and buy a few packs and then have tacos for couple weeks, and then everybody will get tired of the tacos.
Everyone will get tired, exactly.
And then,
why did we start this whole business? But, well, we have a very interesting show. We have a real celebrity here today.
Yes, we do. We have Betty Fussell is in the house today.
If this were the David Letterman show, they would have no band. They would have no second guest. This would be the Betty Fussell Hour.
The Betty Fussell Hour. I like the sound of that. I'm actually going to ask her if she'll adopt me.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Answer well, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, get in see? Line, sister, because I have an email that arrived to her 20 minutes before.
Darn
no.
it.
No, I'm sure you would get a lot less maintenance from if you adopted Shauna. So, well, I guess we should take a break. I mean, any other interesting, like, let's see, did anything big? John Hughes died.
John Hughes died.
I mentioned that on a food show because of the
Breakfast
Club.
Julia, however, came out. That came out this week. That's big in the food world, I guess.
With Meryl Streep playing Julia Child.
Yes.
Did you know Julia Child?
Knew her well.
Oh, my God. Well, let's bring that up since that's a... we're trying to get Meryl Streep to be a guest on the show. She's a very big food person and, you know, she cares a lot about these issues. So maybe like next time Alice is in town or I don't know, we'll try to get Oprah. Oh. She's someone else, although we don't know how to get to her. Meryl, you can still send a letter to
Oprah.
Oh,
yeah? You can?
Seems to have a whole army of interns that are asked to not get the letter all the way to her. But, all right, well, let's take a break, and then we'll come back with Betty, who just most recently, she's written 11 books, but most recently a book on beef called Raising Steaks.
It's a very good book. I have it at home. And a signed copy.
Ooh. There's some double meanings to raising steaks.
Yes, there is. There's a few different ways to raise steak.
One is actually raising beef. That's one. Mm-hmm. Another one is like...
Raising the quality.
Oh, yeah. Oh. Upping the ante. Up. Exactly. Raising the stakes. Also, just like, sounds like moving. The pioneers manifest destiny. They'd raise their stakes. They'd go further west or something.
There you go.
Anything else? Raising.
Well, when we come back, we can ask her what the meaning means.
That's awesome. So we'll take a break and we'll be back. Thank you. Jeez, Nat, way to give me a heart attack. We are engineered formally by Nat, who's made me deaf right now. No. Jack's coming back in.
With the hoedown music, as Betty called it. We're going to...
The tag of all time. Ooh, Jack missed it. Just kidding. Anyway, so we are here with Betty. Betty, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for mimosas.
Fresh squeezed orange.
Fresh squeezed orange.
Betty, where are you coming from today? Like, what part of the city do you live in generally?
I'm coming from Manhattan on the L train, which I catch at 6th Avenue and 14th Street, just around the corner from my house.
Oh, was the L working today?
Yes.
Oh, good. It's actually quite quick. The 7 train and the L train are quite efficient, those ones that go vertical, you know, or
who
horizontal.
Knew? I didn't even think the L ran on Sundays.
Sometimes it doesn't.
Sometimes it doesn't, or it ends at Lorimer, but then there's a bus that takes
you. Yeah, but that's still not fun.
Not fun.
Nope.
So it is an honor to have you. I mean, I don't even know where to start. I mean, you have been a figurehead in the food. When I first started Slow Food, I think you're like one of the first 20 people in my Rubrica Telefonica, which is like a Rolodex Italian style.
That's because I knew Deborah Madison.
Oh, exactly. Well, a lot of people knew you. And at the time, I had known you as a corn expert. I mean, that's how you would, I think Alice Waters introduced me to you that way. Had you just written a book in the mid-90s or something on corn?
That was about it, right.
Okay.
And which book was that?
Yeah, what book?
The Story of Corn. Which, when it came out, there hadn't been any books on a single food subject. It was that long ago. And there also weren't food books without recipes, for which I got totally castigated by everybody. Mm. But, gee, you know, how
look
things
at you
have
now.
Changed. Yeah, I mean, no, it's not me. Look at the food world. What a big change.
Now every book has recipes in it.
Or you have, it's not just that. I mean, the people will read books, whole books, with just little tiny token recipes.
Right, right.
Which they pay no attention to. No.
And now you've written 11 books, correct?
Right, 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 right.
And what was the first one?
The first one was about a silent film comedian named Mabel Normand. Not about food at all, but about the Hollywood tradition of America. Because what interests me as an American is what is it to be an American?
Huh.
And she seemed to me...
Which is
right
your favorite
top.
Book?
I guess the corn, just because it hit a moment when it was still so early, nobody had a clue on what was happening, including me. You know? Uh-huh. I was virgin territory in every sense.
Well, how did you, what made you research it and write a book about that?
Because I'd done an earlier book called I Hear America Cooking, which was about American regional cooking around the United States. And I realized after I'd finished that, I'd done all the ports of entry, east to west, south. But I left out the whole Midwest, which is where my ancestors came from. Mm. Oh, okay. So what was the staple food that I had left out? Corn. Something that we didn't bring as refugees and exiles and, you know, conquistadors from Europe and Asia.
Now, since the writing of that book, of course, corn is now criticized as now being in almost every food and putting in artificially. I mean, back then, before people knew what had happened, like, what was happening right in corn? Or, you know, who did you cover in your book?
I covered a lot of corn farmers, and I really tried to find out how we got that way in the Midwest, which was all settled around 1840 in terms of corn. Yeah. It began not as sustainable, which you have on the East Coast, not as ranching, which you have on the West Coast, but as factory farming. That began a long time ago, a century and a half ago. That's essential. You know, history is essential. And I wanted to know how that happened. And when I started looking into it, I found out that corn had been growing here in this new world since about 10,000 years. Ooh, wow. Okay. So all of that history opened up to my astonishment. I really had no idea that it was the basis of the earliest civilizations, nor did I know that it was the basis of our civilization in terms of agribusiness. Hmm. I found that out in the doing. So thank God somebody like Michael Pollan comes and he picks up that ball and takes it so that people really do get it.
Well, you bring up an interesting point with Michael Pollan. Now, you just said that one of your books was
I
Hear America Cooking. And in his recent piece in the Sunday Times Magazine, he's saying that they're not cooking at all.
Right.
So, I mean, how has something changed in the past 20 years?
As you know, you and Charlie have seen
it. A lot has changed.
I've seen it. It has changed so fast and so rapidly in every way that it's very hard to gauge what is actually happening. This is why I love the pollen piece, because he said, yeah, food is in a big way because you can attach everything to it. Everything fashionable. It is in the fashion mode, replacing sex. Okay, but is anybody actually cooking? No. That's exactly right. It's become a spectator sport. Okay.
Well, actually, you know, I'm okay with it being a spectator sport simply because I think someone like Shauna is a lot more gifted than I am at cooking, you know? So I, you know, don't think it's a problem if people can afford it to eat out four or five times a week. You know, because also there's a lot cheaper food out there. Like sometimes there could be a chef that leaves a great restaurant to open a hot dog stand or a sandwich shop. You know, it is possible to eat delicious chef food for $6.
In New York City.
True.
There's the difference. True. And you were born and raised in New York City, but it's...
Something else exists.
Yes. I think that the piece that Michael Pollan wrote is not about us big city people. It's about the, you know, outside of the cities. You can't go to a place and get a decent hot dog. Mm-hmm. You're going to get the same ballpark Frank you're going to buy in the grocery store.
That's true.
And it's also whether cooking is or is not... whether the kitchen is or is not a part of your daily life in terms not just of you as an eater-consumer, but as an extended family, a family of any kind, two people, three people, your dogs, you know, is it a center or not a center? Like, clearly it isn't. The TV is the center.
A strategy to get this kitchen part of your life is to do like James Beard did, where he just cleared the entire house and made it into one big dining room kitchen. But we don't recommend that at Heritage Radio Network. That's a little extreme.
I do. I mean, you know, the time when everybody knocked down, including me, knocked down the walls between dining room and kitchen, and then the kitchen becomes a living room, in effect. Is the kitchen a living room or not? You can have a TV in there, as many do. But the separation, you know, we can only eat if we eat out. Oh, what does that do to your little kid who's 4, your kid is 11? You know, this is, and Manhattan is full of people who don't have little children that way.
So
other parts of the country are.
Before you started writing books, you raised a family. You, what was eating dinner at your table like? Was there a TV involved?
Oh, God, no. I'm pre-TV. I'm pre-everything. Think back to dinosaurs.
Not really.
My kids didn't even... I think we began with I Love Lucy once a week, you know? but we had absolutely made this gorgeous kitchen, and we were very proud of it, and we were early on, and it was so good that Craig Claiborne came and wrote it up. I mean, you know, that was the big time. We were very thrilled. But in effect, my kids didn't get to eat there very much because I was cooking a la Julia. I was cooking for show. I was cooking for dinner parties. Like crazy, and cooking very complicated things that my kids certainly didn't want to eat.
Now, did you know Julia? I mean, say when you say you were cooking for hire, or I mean, explain what your work was when you were cooking for other people.
Cooking for other people meant friends.
Oh, friends. You always had friends over.
She was entertaining.
That's right. This was in Princeton, which was nothing except eating in other people's dining rooms because there were no restaurants, and there still aren't, are any good. Okay. So it's not just out there in the Midwest that you can't eat out. There are whole pockets of
What was a typical dinner on a Friday evening with the...
Typical dinner for guests would be, I mean, I remember the one from Julia that we were all terribly excited about because we began with goujonnière. You have to make your own hors d'oeuvre. Everything was the rules of you have to do it yourself because that was how you boosted your status as a housewife. When you weren't on a tennis court.
It's so funny because now there's a do-it-yourself movement here in Brooklyn, you know. And
yes,
so.
There is a do-it-yourself.
In a professional. So it's come around in all kinds of funny circles.
They're
snake
making
biting
beer. Making everything.
Yeah, making chocolate. I mean, yum, yes. Oh, yes. Do more.
Now, did you know James Beard and Julia Child?
Yes, I knew. I met Julia when I was writing my first food book called Masters of American Cookery. And that was about Julia and Jim and MFK Fisher and Craig Claiborne. So I thought, you know, these people, these were guys, they were all wrote books, and that's who formed people like me. Because we didn't learn at our mother's or grandmother's knees, obviously. not in the world of cans from the Midwest. And Julia was absolutely wonderful about that book. She was such a generous person, so I never recovered from my full admiration for her. So this was when she had just started, really, the television, so I got to interview her.
What years did she start TV?
Oh, 1961, was it? It was right after 1960 when the book came out.
So, and where did
this
she...
This is up in Boston, et cetera.
What time slot was she given when she first started? Was she ever, like, prime time on Channel 13 or something?
Oh, God, no. I mean, this is GBH in Boston, so, I mean, you know, this is already a tiny little... By your standards?
Yes.
No, Manhattan right there. She's like, a little local provincial station up there in Boston.
He doesn't know anything outside of New York.
She's all right. Where's there a sound effect? I'm being ganged up on.
Where's that hoedown music?
Have you ever traveled out of New York City, Patrick?
I'm in Brooklyn, aren't I, sister?
Oh, that's right. You've crossed the river. You just moved to Williamsburg. Living it up on the Brooklyn side. You've crossed over to the cooler side, I should say.
So are you going to see this movie that's coming out about
Julia? Well, I just
saw it. Oh, you saw it?
Right. And because I'm a great, naturally I'm a Meryl Streep fan. Naturally I'm a Nora Ephron fan because they're both fabulous at their crafts. But I had never read anything of the Julie story, so... I'm not sure that the movie worked for me because it kind of doubled everything that was there. It's already a Cinderella story that gets doubled. It's a romance, love romance, married, not so full of conflict. That's a hard thing to get over. So it's a kind of, it's a little bit of, I don't think
puff
it
piece.
Quite worked. It ends up feeling like a puff piece for
or
both of them.
Or it's like a deflated souffle. It was meant to be a puff piece, but it's...
I'll go with that.
Décassé.
It is wonderful to see and kind of revivify Julia once again. I mean, also it works on
and
that.
And I love that someone of Meryl's caliber would take on a culinary role. You know, this isn't a great politician.
Someone of Meryl's beauty that can take on a non-physical beauty type and create a living person. That is the genius of Streep's performance, and it works.
I wonder, does she just mess with people and, like, pretend to be really angry or really sad? Or
Meryl Streep?
Yeah, like, with her daughter or, like, people at the deli. And she's like, I'm just kidding, I was acting. And they're like, oh, my God.
I don't think anybody ever knows. Ask your family.
Oh, wow. So, well, very interesting. And James Beard, did you ever...
Yeah, I took courses from James Beard when he was just around the corner from me on his 12th Street house. And another person, huge and generous, except he had a bitchy side. Well, everybody knows that. All right.
But was he this great charismatic...
He was the great Buddha by the time I got to know him. He did nothing in our cooking class. We all worked ourselves to the bone, of course, and all kinds of people, and that was great fun. But James sat there and smiled benignly, and, you know, dipping his finger in from time to time, always saying, more butter, you know.
That is funny. He comes from Portland, which is a great culinary city to this day. I mean, I don't know if it ever was, but now it is.
Well, you know, the four stars for me and the four pioneers in this, three of them were from the West Coast. The other one was from the South. They were all from outside Manhattan, and that matters.
And those are... All right.
MFK Fisher, yeah. Craig Claiborne, Julia Child, and James Beard.
And
that's because they all wrote books.
Well, one time when I first started Slow Food, the first person I met, I went to Remy with Florence Fabrican. She's like, don't forget, all movements start in New York City. And they emanate. Movements seldom start out and come in.
So. She talks like a New Yorker. Isn't that odd? She may be from New Jersey or Long Island. Okay.
Yeah,
well, there we go. How amazing.
No, well, I do say this, and then we can move on. Garrett Oliver once told me that all French citizens pay a small tax, no matter where they are in France, to Paris to maintain that city. And I kind of think, you know, I see New York in that same way, even though the rest of America never would.
That's exactly the difference between France, a tiny country the size of Rhode Island, and the United States of America, which is the size of China. Don't get me on it.
Oh, my God. I know. This is...
She just put you in your place.
I'm talking to such an expert on American culture and stuff. Can we cut to break and play something American? Very American.
Some more of that hoedown music? That's great.
Get that woman off my back.
Oh, good.
This is Heritage Radio Network, and we are here at Roberta's in Bushwick, East Williamsburg, same neighborhood, pretty much.
Yeah.
And we're brought to you by White Oak Pastures. And we're talking to Betty Fussell, and that was some great American music on our break there. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about food trends. We touched on that a little bit earlier. Being green is trendy. Eating local organic is trendy. Stars are getting into it. You see that it's being mentioned more and more. Do you think that this is going to last? It's going to become an everyday life for a lot of people, or is this just passing?
The trendiness has happened so rapidly and pervasively in the media, it's very hard to tell, because what I see is that we're in a period of immense change, obviously. And it's very hard. We're sorting ourselves out. And the fact of the way in which food networks have gone gangbusters, who would have predicted that 10 years ago? When I was first on the Food Network, I said, 24 hours a day running a food program? Are they out of their minds? And the only person I knew who watched then was the doorman at a building who said, oh, I saw you. I saw you on television. I said, really? He said, yeah. It was 3 a.m. and I couldn't go to sleep. You know,
awesome.
That's okay. That's very recent. But at the same time that we're floating on this level of green, sustainable, organic, and think, hey, wow, everybody's changing. No, it's not everybody. At the same time that that is happening, everything that has been going in the industrial machine is going even more so, bigger, much more comprehensive. As we were talking earlier, Brazil turns out to be the world's largest exporter of beef. It has the world's largest processing company, JBS. SA, that SA means South America. All these things are happening at the same time. The economic realities are gigantic. So, do our little green people, how do you sort it all out?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very vocal group, but like even with our bellies, you know, we process about 150 pigs a week. We still can't sell 300 bellies. Even in the whirlwind of this return to the lesser cuts and curing, like, we still cannot sell all our bellies on a week in and week out basis. So I hear what you're saying. There's the rarefied air, and then there's the rest of the world, you know.
There's the rest of the world, and it's the world that makes the difference, because we have not begun to catch up to the global economics that we're all a part of.
Well, it's also the rest of the world in the sense, don't be mistaken, that it's not just America that's into all this largely processed foods. In Europe, too, it's very prominent. And, and when you go there and travel in Italy and Spain, and their grocery stores are becoming more and more packed with the frozen food section just as much as ours are.
That's been true for the last 40 years. I mean, this is...
But they like to act like that's not ever been true.
Well, they're pretending. They're good actors. Italians are always good actors, and so are the French, you know. Well, of course. But the model for the global economy is the industrial process. Okay, that is everywhere. Look at China coming up fast. You want to talk about evils of industrialism, just give it 20 years. Okay, let the little greenies. What are you going to do about that, little greenies?
Well, listen, we are, I think the greenies are doing one thing, and they're creating their own independent orbit that just doesn't need, they're becoming self-sufficient, they're, you know, creating their own trucking system, you know, from upstate New York. I mean, it's small.
And it depends upon money. So yeah. This is a leisure, tiny field, which thank God for it,
right.
And is crucial. But this depends upon affluence, which we are losing. America, number one power, we're losing that.
Do you think that beef is the comeback of beef and meats in general is a trend that's going to go away soon?
It's part of the global affluence. The meat consumption in every country in the world has gone up. Something to the, you know, approaching the percentages that we had in the 1980s and 90s, you know, suddenly meat is, it's a sign, it's always been a sign of affluence. Watch China again on its beef consumption. Or
It's going to go up. And are we going down here in the States, you think?
We're going down on producing, aren't we? You tell me in what we're not. It's not just cars, it's beef. We're now number two in exports, not number one.
Right.
But who's paying attention? Not the people who are talking about natural organic. And thank God somebody is. So.
And you also talked about, you mentioned something What is it? Fat as the comeback kid?
The comeback kid.
Yeah, thank God. I mean,
we have a sound effect for that. It's taken off.
It's taken off. Fat is taken off.
Never fat enough, I'm happy to say. Including people. I mean, you know, let's get these
you
priorities.
You should be quoted
straight.
In magazines for that.
Okay, so the fat magazines already are quoting that. But never mind. It's part of the meat thing, too, again. The trends in which a single ingredient will be evil or good is so American, it makes me very impatient. I mean, you know, get a life, America. You're not going to have immortality by having 16 cups of coffee, as a friend recently said. Hey, do you know the latest thing against Alzheimer's is to have 16 cups of coffee? It's all that caffeine. Oh, thank you.
You'll just end up crazy.
Don't worry. They don't believe that in New York City.
They don't believe anything in New York City, so they're not safe.
So then, on the other side of that, I hear that you're unsympathetic towards vegans.
I've always been. I'm young.
Uh-oh. Ooh, you gotta get a sound effect for that one.
See, that sounds like the St. Vincent's Hospital. I mean, that's the ambulance outside my church. Okay. Well, yes.
Well, this is what vegans are, maybe. This is the... Okay. They're descending on our pleasure.
What is it about vegans that you...
It's the bloody Puritanism.
Okay.
In studying American
rightly
culture.
Said.
And coming out of a very, very puritanical family from the Midwest, Calvins all the way, Calvinists. My big thing has been, I'll join Julian saying, you know, food is fun, food is pleasure. The body is fun, the body is pleasure. It's not about sin and salvation. And veganism takes it right back to sin and salvation. So I'm again the initial propositions that these things are evil.
Now, do you, having done research for your beef book and many other books with livestock, I mean, anytime you've crossed it, did you ever ask that question? Is this humane? Is this correct? I mean, have you ever seen a slaughter? I mean, by the way, I'm not a vegan, but I just to play devil's advocate.
No, but the reason I'm so again veganism is they're not taking into account the fact that life feeds on life. Death is a necessary part of life. That includes death of animals for our benefit. Yeah. That includes our deaths for each other's benefit. So I've been to slaughterhouses. I've been to good ones. I've been to bad ones. I've seen humane practices. I've seen inhumane. So it's not about the animals. Not eating animals is not going to save the planet.
Mm-hmm. I think that somebody had recently asked Peter Hoffman, because we do these crazy crab boils at Back 40.
And Peter Hoffman's the owner of Savoy restaurant
in
Back 40.
And a reporter had asked him, how does he feel about killing so many crabs a week? And he basically said, let's stop worrying about, you know, killing the animal and start worrying about how we treat the animals while they're living. And that just, I think, says so much about really caring about where your food comes from.
And remember, we are animals, human beings. Human beings are animals. We are not plants. We're animals. You know?
Yes.
And how we treat each other and regard each other as to our lives and deaths. All of that influences our sentimentality about animals as somehow distinct from our human species. Whoops. Mm-hmm. Let's not do that.
Right.
And in fact, if I see one more movie about lobsters being killed, and unfortunately, Nora Ephron succumbs to that.
Uh-oh.
There's another Annie Hall lobster scene. Oh, spare me.
Oh, my Lord.
You don't think lobsters have feelings?
I don't give a shit whether they have feelings or not. That's not what it's about. You don't know whether they have feelings. I don't know either. I want a lobster for dinner. That's what I know.
Right.
Very well said. Is there an applause on there?
Yes, there is. Yeah.
Get to bleep that. Myself. Oh, I forgot.
No. This is... There you go. That doesn't need to be bleeped, right? This is a...
No.
I think our sponsors might agree with you.
Exactly. Shit can be used if it's in the right... If it's correct. I mean, that word exists for certain reasons. You know?
All the bad words exist
All the words exist for reasons.
I mean, like in Europe, don't they? Nudity is allowed. Cursing is allowed. You know, as long as it's
but
not
everywhere
gratuitous.
But everywhere but the Manhattan. Puritanical USA.
That's all right.
It is a very puritanical society.
Still, to
this day. Yeah.
And maybe forever. I don't know. Certainly through my lifetime.
Now, what did you see with your current book, Raising Stakes? Like, how do you do research? I mean, do you try to get there firsthand and see the farmers face-to-face? How do you make your appointments? Like, what cities did you go
to? Face-to-face is exactly right. And for me, what is so stunning about this country is its totally extreme geographies. Mm-hmm. You know, so you have the desert west, you have the wet pasture east. They really have no relationship to each other geographically, except they're in the same landmass. And geography so conditions culture. And the East politically, and because of the nature of American history, imposed its will and its mind structure on a desert where it made no sense whatsoever. And it still does. All the laws about land use come out of the East. That's going to change because we're going to run out of water. But until it does, and it's the water that suffers in the West, and that's where all your corns, your major crops, and your major livestock. Okay, there'll be some changes, and they'll happen whether we want them or not.
So you mean to go less from an East Coast vision to more one that is appropriate for each region?
The fact that the government historically is seated in the East matters. Jefferson set up the grid.
So tell me in precise, this Eastern philosophy, like with water, for instance, are you talking like Los Angeles? Or are you talking like the salmon runs in Oregon? Like, what water issues are not being thought about?
None of them are being thought about. Because we were set up to think of farming as sustainable. 160 acres, all of those laws that went in. That's what I call the Jeffersonian grid. The way it was settled. Farms are supposed to be sustainable. That is possible only when you have pasture land the way England and the continent have it.
Right.
That's where that mindset came from. You apply that mindset to the Los Angeles, Southern California desert where I grew up, and it's laughable.
And what should it change? What should change? They should be bigger lots or smaller?
No. The whole mindset has to change on the way water is distributed through regions, not by people tapping into the Colorado as they've done for the last 100 years. It'll happen very quickly with Las Vegas. The desertification of Las Vegas. You heard it here first. That's going to happen real fast because everybody has a lawn and there is zero water.
Right.
That's true. They do.
The
they have
desertification
all these little
cookie
cutter houses with lawns and. And I'm sure they turn their sprinkler on.
Exactly. And you know, who wants a lawn? That's an Eastern idea.
Right. So is the pool the West one, even though they have shortages of water?
Yeah, what are you going to use for water for your pool? Let's think about that. You're going to recycle your lawn water. Okay, what if you have no lawn water?
You're a danger to lawn game companies.
They better hire me to get some advice.
You're like, go to an indoor version. Don't use spikes. Use suction cups. But no, very interesting. And tell us, there's so many questions. What is your secret to, staying healthy and all that? I mean, like, what foods have you eaten for most of your life? Like, has there been some that have been consistent throughout?
I follow Julia Child. Mm-hmm. The secret to health is to pick your grandparents very carefully. Which, actually, I did. They all died in their 80s and 90s.
Wow.
And they ate probably... I've never dieted a day in my life. They all had high metabolisms. That was lucky. Okay. If I'd known to choose that, I would have. But I have eaten absolutely everything and continue to and adore
food. Not everything like McDonald's.
I have once been to a McDonald's.
Once.
And like their French fries. I like their French fries.
Yeah, sure.
Was that whenever they used to fry it in beef fat?
That's when they had it in beef fat. That's right.
How did I know that one?
It's very fascinating. I mean, for people who aren't at the studio, but they've been listening in, Betty has written 11 books, but all after the age of 55, which I think is really inspirational.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Live long.
Live long.
And we've covered so many interesting topics. I almost don't know where to go from it because we only have like 5-6 more minutes. So did you have one last question? I had one last one.
Go ahead.
But you go first.
What inspired you to start writing?
A terrible need and terrible opposition.
Okay.
Okay, well, I guess that... who I wanted to kind of ask about, like, who you think controls the, you know, food world. Like, there's the industrials, and then within the sustainable food world, there's also a kind of inner power circle. Like, the rise of food publications, blogging, you know, all that kind of, like, how the world communicates with itself. Used to just be Julia Child. Now, what is it, and where is it going?
I'm fascinated by the blog world. I mean, do I care what they had for breakfast? Jim and Nancy? No, but there are so many millions of them, they're going to sort themselves out. And some of those people we're going to want to go back to. And I'm not sure why. I don't think it's about writing. I think it's about, you know, Norman Mailer. Anybody remember who he was? 100 years ago, wrote an essay called Advertisements for Myself. That's what every blog is. Every person is now his own. It's not about writing. It's about it's about marketing. Every person is his own marketer. This is a fascinating thing. And out of that, you know, some wonderful food comes, like this black garlic, which yesterday was unheard of and is now in everybody's refrigerator. Whoops, how'd that get? Distributed by blogs, thousands and thousands and millions of blogs.
But do you think that might be part of people wanting to tap into a little bit of fame? That the whole world of...
They want to tap into a lot of fame.
Yeah, they're hoping to be found.
They're hoping to be found like a movie, Julie and Julie. It's exactly what they're hoping for. Of course. Why not?
Yeah, sure.
That's not a bad idea.
And it's empowering. It's empowering, you know, in the depersonalization of
computers. Power is from one thing only in this country, and that is money, which brings fame. Or fame, which brings money. Same thing. It's about the power game.
And, you know, we only have a couple more minutes. Tell us what most inspires you. I mean, in all your travels and books that you've written and seeing all these different Americans, I mean, besides the territories being so different, actually, can you speak to what the American people are?
Like, no, but I can speak to the pleasure of food in that everybody will talk about food, like right here now. And everyone will reveal himself most through talk about food. Not through what he eats, but the way he talks about it. The way he talks about it to somebody else, like me. I love that.
Fantastic.
That's a great thing.
Are you working on another book that we can...
Of course.
Tell us. Can you break some news here?
Well, I'm not sure when it will come out because I'm still working on the proposal, but I want to do something like How to Cook a Coyote. Oh. The coyote at the door, not the wolf, because we're in hard times.
Yes, guys, I'm going
to
do it.
Oh, there we go.
That was the one time where the engineer, they were like, he's going to do the wolf, right?
They're on it. Okay. There are coyotes in Boston. They'll be in Manhattan any day now because we've killed off the wolves.
So you're talking about a hunting book, it sounds like.
I'm going hunting with my son in who lives in Mount Tina. I'm going there in October. I, who am blind and have never shot a rifle, we're going to hunt a deer.
Better, don't just wear orange. Actually have a siren going off if you're going to be in Montana. But that's very, very interesting.
But not hunting for game, hunting for food.
Well, if you're a real hunter, you hunt for food. It just happens to be game.
Very interesting. Well, thank you so much for coming. It's a real honor for you to come out. Did you enjoy the food here at Roberta's?
Oh, I had polenta. Oh, it was so good. Polenta, everybody, is cornmeal mush.
Polenta is very good.
Well, we will come back for a brief conclusion. And okay. This is the main course. So here we are on as turning out to be lovely Sunday afternoon.
Thankfully, it was kind of gloomy.
If it's Sunday, it's the main course.
It's the main course here at Heritage Radio.
There were a bunch of important people to today. We had White Oak Pastures sponsors us through a flashing logo on our website, which is really awesome that they invested in HRN. It was also me. I'm Patrick Martins. You're
Shauna Pacifico.
And where can people taste your food, Shauna Pacifico?
At Back 40 Restaurant, which is in the East Village in Manhattan.
That's awesome. Jowl Nuggets. I'm sorry, I have to say it.
Will I ever come on this show without you mentioning the Jowl Nuggets?
It's a true invention with people's mad rush to invent something new that hasn't been done and often failing, you know, because it might be new, but it's not good.
Is it really new?
I mean, the Jowl Nugget. Come on.
It's fried pork fat. Like it's
the jowl, a meaty jowl. You're very precise about what you want.
Betty's over here panting beside me.
It's the perfect chicken McNugget. I'm sure the
cheeky McNugget.
Oh, very nice.
Or we wanted to call it face bacon, but we stuck with pork jowl nuggets for the menu. For
yeah, exactly. So yeah,
that's pretty famous though.
We're engineered by Jack Inslee, and we're produced by Jack Inslee, engineered by Nat Wiener. They've very been cool. doing an amazing job. They've been doing all the shows this past week because a few people are on vacation.
Ah, summertime. It's August. Vacation time.
Are you doing a show on next Sunday?
I don't know yet. We'll have to discuss that. We'll play it by ear. I had somebody I wanted to do it with, but they will be out of town because it's August.
It is.
So
they closed down in Italy like 3 weeks. Everything was closed in the town of Bra when I lived.
Most of Europe, Western Europe, they all, like the whole month of August, everybody goes on vacation.
There's only one pharmacy open, you know, and you have to like look in the yellow pages for their hours.
Yes, they run by weird hours over there. I remember when I was backpacking in Europe and I wanted to buy something and the guy refused to let me go, even though he was sitting there because it was his lunch break. And I was you're really going to turn away my money because you want to sit?
At the end of my long three and a half week trip, I did three week trips with Carlo Petrini around the United States. And when we were like tidbin with each other for 3 weeks, we were like kind of annoyed. And, you know, I was like, are we going to stop for food? And he's like, no slow food intern will ever go hungry. And we, of course, pulled off. We actually stopped at a Denny's, and he found it so clean. He was like, this is the cleanest restaurant I've ever been in.
I would probably say that most of those places are pretty clean. They rub everything down with alcohol.
Yeah, including the food.
Yes, including the
That's
food.
That's what it is. It's safe.
It's safe food to eat.
I heard I won't say this, but sometimes places have it that if you drop your food, they have to give you another one for free.
If they drop your food?
No, if you drop your food.
Oh, well, if somebody drops their food at my restaurant, if they drop a whole burger,
you give it to?
Yeah, I mean, on a case-by-case basis, but I mean, I wouldn't be like, have it you was ever an been accident. Like,
no? You're like, sorry, dude.
No, not really. There's sometimes when people will return something to the kitchen and there's one bite left and they're like, we didn't like this. And that's kind of like, really? You managed to eat the whole entire dish and now you're telling me you don't like it? So there's a point of putting your foot down and not letting people take advantage of the situation. But there's, you know.
Absolutely.
It's a case-by-case basis, you know.
Well, thanks so much. This was a great show. Betty Fussell was
one
amazing.
One of my favorite people ever.
Buy her books, all 11 of them.
All 11.
You can now buy a collector set on the Heritage Radio Network.
You should have a little box set of books.
That'd be good. Sell them at farmers markets. All right. Well, we will be back probably next week or the week after.
Yes.
Thanks for listening.
All right. Bye.